Hey everybody, I'm Debbie Davis and I'm an alcoholic. And it's really great to be here. Thank you, Lee, for the invitation. I always look forward to coming down to Central California and your enthusiasm and just the fellowship and the community that I see here. I love standing in line with Peter, and he's telling me he's moving down to the San Diego area. And without any prompting, he just starts telling me he's going to get into general service and get into that whole thing. And that just, when I hear stuff like that, I just, like, my heart just soars, because that's the music of, to me, what I need in my recovery as a whole, is to be a part of AA as a whole, to get out of my chair at the meeting and to be a part of the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, and I just get excited about being around people like that. It feels like home folk. And so thank you for the invitation. Lynn, happy birthday. So its birthdays are great to celebrate. I recently celebrated one, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But I also want to welcome our new members, whether you're here to Alcoholics Anonymous for your first time or your umpteenth time. I just hope it's your last time. I hope this is the time that you stay, that you put your sobriety date in ink, and that this is the time that you get all in. Because I've been in both places, so I know the different feeling that is. And being all in took those questions away. And the things, simple things that I've been asked to do to keep that sobriety date is minimal compared to what I see going out there, what I remember I used to do to have to just keep it all moving and in the air. And this really, for me, has been the easier, softer way. And that's what my purpose is tonight, is to share with you my journey, my experience, strength, and hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. The day finally came for me, and it was a Saturday night where I finally hit a bottom. I had heard you talk about hitting bottom, surrender, gift of desperation. I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I intellectually knew what you were talking about, but I knew I wasn't there. I had not experienced that. Everything for me was just information. I could nod, yeah, but it never went below my eyebrows of relating in reality to what you were saying. I could not say, I know how you feel, because I didn't. I intellectually understood it, and so I never really gave this much time or thought. I visited Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 months, and visit was probably a generous word. And that this day finally came when I had my second relapse, and it wasn't any big deal. It wasn't a rip-roaring, ended up in jail from robbing a bank, cross state lines, nothing like that. It was just kind of the end of, you know how when you have a balloon and you let the air out and that's about how exciting it was, you know. And yet it was the very incident that would kick me off the fence of reservation and indecision and made that, what I call, and many of you know too, that shift, that 2-foot drop. From my head being all yakety-yak and information to that 2-foot drop where I admitted for the first time to my innermost self, as Chapter 3 talks about, that I am an alcoholic. And now I knew that feeling of what you had talked about. I knew that life, altered just enough, no longer held a pull or an attraction or a desire for me. And we talk about a psychic change. I was talking about that with a sponsee the other day. We were reading in chapter 4, and on that one page, I can't quote the page number, but it makes reference to the word psychic change 3 times, so it must mean something, you know. And I looked at that psychic change as mine, how it affected me. So that Saturday afternoon, before the relapse, I still saw you and I as very different. I found all the differences. The relapse happens, and without even a prayer, there's a shift in me. And it's amazing how, like a fog moving out, I started to feel and see our similarities. Now, everything changed, and yet you had not changed. What happened? And that was that shift within me that nobody and no thing could make happen. It was just going to be my moment where all the stars seemed to line up. And that, for me, that experience was like I emotionally and spiritually just flatlined. And between that kind of death breath, if you will, and the new life breath, the thought came into my mind, and I know it was from a power greater than me, that those people in AA seem to know what to do. And that new heartbeat, ever so slightly, that 1 degree change. And it wasn't like I had this big jump up and down, rip, you know, everything's going to be different from now on. It just was a shift. And that was on Saturday night. Sunday, I'm sober all day long, and I go to the weekly meeting. So I used to go to one meeting a month, and because that's all I was required to go to. I'm not going to like go to two, join AA and go to 2 meetings in a month. And so after the first relapse, I ramped it up from 1 a month to 1 a week. And that's all I did differently. I still didn't get a sponsor. I've got a big book somewhere. I walked into the meeting when it started, left when it was over, and then got her done. That became a checklist item. That's about as much emotion and giving to this as I gave. And so I decided to go to the meeting early. I went 20 minutes early, and compared to what I'd been doing, that was kind of like going the day before. You know, I mean, like, who goes that early, right, to the meetings? Well, you'll find out, or I found out, the old-timers go, so that goofy people like me can ask questions about this thing. And that was the next thing I did out of character or recent habit of 10 months, is I asked a question. Because when you're Miss Know-It-All, as I was, you don't ask questions. You don't want to show your hand that you don't know. You'll figure this out somehow. But I'm not always that good at figuring it out. But I kind of know if you ask a question, then they might expect you to do something. So it's just better to not ask questions. But I asked them a question, and I said, what do you do to stay sober? End of question. Now, as important as the question was, to me, I think more, as important, if not more important, was the way I was going to listen to their answer. And it's still the way that I need to listen to the suggestions given to me and the experience, is I had to listen to it without any yeah buts. I had to listen to it without conditions in my mind. I might not have verbalized them. I had to listen to it without negotiation. Either, again, within or verbally. I couldn't dumb it down to my convenient level, because otherwise I'm just, why waste their time in asking the question if I'm not going to do anything and I'm going to dumb it down? If I want to change, I got to step it up. I can't take it down to my level. That's how I got to my level, is doing only what I wanted to do when I felt like doing it. And that wasn't going to produce any change. And so I began to listen to what they said. And they shared with me the series of things. I look at it again. There's a phrase in their book. They laid out the simple kit of spiritual tools. And they didn't hand them to me. They said, here they are. You're going to have to pick them up one at a time. That's how I interpreted that. What they shared with me was for me to take any time I wanted to pick it off the table and change. And they started with One day at a time, we don't take that first drink. Now, for me, that included the other things that I was doing, too. I understood that for me. That was going to change the way that I felt, the way that I thought. And I thought, well, you know what? For the first time, I'm really ready to do this. This is as good a day as any to make as a sobriety date. And that was February the 8th, 1976, which means I've been here with you 40 years and a little over a month. You know, so who would have thought that, right? 40 years. I mean, I still am. It's like, is someone else saying that? It just doesn't seem like it's me because, you know, I got sober when I was young. I was like 5 years old when I got sober. Pretty soon I'm going to have my experience in virtual and I'll be born sober, you know, who knows, in AA. But it's hard to believe because I don't even feel 40 years old, let alone have been here with you. But I did get sober young. I got sober chronologically. I was 18 years old. I mean, emotionally, I was 5 years old, that's for sure, I'll tell you. Very immature, very childish. But chronologically, I was 18. I've never had a legal drink of alcohol, and I hope I never do. But at that time, that Saturday afternoon, my age was an issue. Only with me. Nobody else. Nobody ever said to me I was too young. No one ever said to me I spilled more than you drank. No one ever said to me you're here a little early. Yes, they've all said, gee, I wish I got there when you did, blah, blah. And I know that because the amazing life I've gotten to live for 40 years is a life beyond, I wouldn't have been, you know, you hear about wildest drunken dreams, and I remember thinking several years sober, what were those wild drunken dreams? Mine were so boring. They lived from last weekend to the next weekend with drinking in between. My world was so itty-bitty tiny. There was no armchair traveler, no big deal person I was going to be. I lived in such a tiny cubicle of the world. And now I get to be a part of the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Who would have known how to do that? And so I start with that sobriety date. And just to give you a little drinking background, I do that for new people to help identify because that's about what they relate to in that first year or so. But after that, it's the rest of the people in the room, I think, I know I asked, so how have you stayed sober? How have you stayed sober once you kind of got over the first year of things new for the first time? How do you stay here through life happenings? And so just a little bit about my drinking is I was raised in the Midwest. I had always wanted to be a Southern Belle, and God started me in South Dakota, you know. I'd eventually get to Atlanta, but wouldn't be for a while. And I started with really nice parents, kind, caring, cookie baking, lawn mowing, church going, tax paying kind of people. Good, good Midwestern people. No alcoholic problems. The dusty whiskey bottle on the top shelf that God knows how long it had been there. It was dusty till I got to drinking, but prior to that, it was the dusty whiskey bottle, and it was, you know, the kind of drinking I saw was really what we call social drinking. I drink it for dinner if they had company over, but there was no evening cocktails or anything like that, and they would eat, and they, you know, whatever buzz they might have started totally killed that. They'd have coffee later, and they'd go home. No lampshade wearing, no lawn mowing, driving, you know, none of that kind of stuff. And so my parents would, though, separate a little bit later on in that same year. Lots of changes are going on in my life. You know what it's like when you're 12 years old, and lots of changes are going on for you in all kinds of ways. And I was wanting to hang out with some, get in with a group of friends. That's natural. That's not alcoholic. It's just human. And when you're a budding teen, that's what you want to do, get a gang of friends. And I didn't belong with the athletes. I didn't belong with the academics. But there was this group over here smoking cigarettes, drinking beer, skipping school. And I don't know, I was just drawn to that group of people. And so finally I got invited to the party. This is Monday, the party's Friday. I could not wait to go. I mean, wild horses could not have kept me from going to this party. My life depended on this, right? How dramatic we are at that time. And so between Monday and Friday, I knew what I was going to do. I'd heard him talk about drinking. I don't remember anyone talking about drunk. But for some reason, I got to Friday morning and I had a very clear decision that I'm going to get drunk tonight. Because I think that's the most you can do or be. And so I got to shoot for the top. This is my debut. I've got to be in with this group of kids and I got to shoot for the mark. So we, like many of you, I remember that first night of drinking, and we're 12 and 13 years old. It's kind of like a liquid potluck, you know, whatever you stole from somewhere and you brought and you put it in mix. And I don't even think God knew what was all there, to tell you the truth. It was such a mess when you're teenagers, you know. But the first thing I drank was something out of a brown paper bag. I haven't a clue what it was. It didn't matter. I knew booze was in there. Could have been kerosene. I still would have drank it. It would not have mattered. And it's making it circle around, and I kind of watched what they were doing. Got to me. I wanted to act like I did this all the time. You know how you are. And so I take a big old pull off that bottle. I give it to the next guy, and oh, my God, I have no idea that it would be like this. It just ripped out my throat. You know, I'm just flip-flopping on the inside, trying to look cool on the outside, but I'm just, you know, flipping out on the inside. And I know my throat's gone, but there's this strange thought that comes from behind that says, hey, don't worry about that stuff. You can always get another throat. Just keep going for it. Just keep doing what you're doing. I don't know why that was just this calming. It was sort of my way of saying it's going to be okay to myself. And what happened when that first drink went down and it hit that bottom on the inside was that there was no magic or parade happening, but my shoulders relaxed. I wasn't running away from a horrible home life, violence, abuse, neglect, nothing at all. I came from a very nice family. I just simply wanted to get in with these kids, and nobody forced me to drink. Nobody pressured me into doing that. I couldn't wait to do it. I was obsessed before I took my first drink with alcohol. And there's this warm glow 2 inches behind my belly button, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm 12 years old and oatmeal has never done this for me. You know, I don't know what's in there, but I want more of it. And it came around to me again, and I couldn't wait to have another pull off of that, and because I want more of that feeling. And I took that second pull, gave it to the next guy. Throat's a little seasoned now, you know, from that first one, so it's not as bad. And when it went down the second time, if there is a line that we cross from social to alcoholic drinking, I just pole vaulted over that line between the first and second drink. That first drink was, please accept me. That second drink was, aren't you glad I'm here? You know, how do you go from A to Z in moments? You know, booze did that. And I loved this new empowerment that I felt. And I no longer needed you. I went into a world within myself. And again, like Clancy talks about, everything changed, yet nothing changed. My perception of you was different. My perception of me and my world was different. And booze was that change. And that night I would set a lot of patterns for me. The patterns don't make me an alcoholic, because there's people who have had 1, 2, 3, or none of these things happen. These would be pretty regular for me. And for me, it would be, I would drink as much as I could, whatever, whenever, however, with whomever. It didn't matter. Once that first drink was in, the gate was open. Secondly, I would begin to black out night number one. I passed out the first night. I came to with my first case of the dry heaves. I looked at all that stuff as, okay. It was a very acceptable part of the package. So there wasn't, I drank for a period of time, then blacked out. All that stuff happened night number one. So it's my assumption that all happened to the people I was with. And no wonder they drank if they get the feeling I'm getting. But I didn't know that I was the only little kid that got drunk that night. They all really did just have some drinking going on. They did not do what I did. So that's Friday night. They drug me home from the party, and I couldn't wait to go back. They wouldn't take me back, but I couldn't wait to do it again. Saturday, now there are two symptoms as I read our literature that define me as an alcoholic. One is the mental obsession. As I said, I had that mental obsession before I even picked up the first drink. Friday morning when I woke up, I had good ideals at the forethought, which had been that's who I am. Do the right thing, be a good student, be a good daughter, stay out of trouble. That's just who I am. And then the second thought there was, get drunk tonight. Now, I didn't know they'd come into conflict with each other, but on Saturday morning, those were in reverse. And I woke up thinking about drinking, and those good ideals are eventually going to be one by one removed from the list, because I can't drink this way I want to and do that. And so drinking and everything around it started that night, where I would go, what I would do, the money, etc. The other thing was that allergy, the phenomenon of craving. I didn't understand that right away because I don't have any other allergies. But an allergy, my definition of the book is a dictionary, is an unusual reaction to a substance not found in most people. That I do have. I don't know that when I take that first drink, the commitments are gone, the promises are gone. What I said is no longer is just a memory, I don't even remember. And I do not have the ability to control my behavior or my drinking. I didn't know that. But night number one, all those two symptoms were activated. And that next day, I found a way to get alcohol. I'm, again, 12 years old. It's a little harder sometimes. I was drinking by myself because I don't want to share. I mean, I already know this from the first night of drinking. I don't want to share. And I get caught. And I've never been a good liar to date. And I lied, of course, and I made the decision not that, you are a little young, maybe you should wait till you're of legal age to drink. No, my decision was, you're going to have to learn how to be a better liar. That was my decision. I would drink to the best of my ability at every given opportunity, plus weekends. A year later, I'm introduced to the wonderful world of drugs, which allowed me to stay conscious longer before the inevitable blackout. I found things that helped keep me alert, okay? I wasn't into sleeping through my drinking. I want to be in the middle of everything. I want to be up for days. I want to drink as long as I can. And I found things like speed and acid will help you. And so that's when I began to incorporate. And I'll tell you, they'll get you there quicker and in color, you know? And I'm all up for some excitement. And so I just ramped it up as fast as I could go, and at 17 and a half years old, I have now been drinking over a year and a half on a daily basis. Again, I don't think anything of this. I'm trying to be all things to all people. I'm trying to control and handle my drinking and stay as low a trouble as I possibly can. I've been expelled from my senior year of high school three times, all for my drinking. And my father had tried all human power to relieve me of my alcoholism, the B of the ABCs and how it works. And he did not know what to do. He finally sought professional advice. He said, I don't know what to do. And they knew what he was dealing with, and they suggested that he commit me to a program while he still had the legal custody to do so. And in May of 1975, I was put in a treatment program for alcoholism and drug addiction. And as I said earlier, I found all the differences from you. We would be taken to outside meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on Friday nights, and it was like, has it come to this? You know, I mean, my life has gone from exciting to the gray, dreary rooms of AA and little chairs and stuff like that. And I would sit in the back and I would distract myself as long as I could and during that home meeting. And every now and then I would tune into what the speaker was saying, which is what I'm doing tonight. As they just shared their experience, strength, and hope, and the encouragement with that, I would find something to identify with. And of course, I don't want to. I mean, I'm not the brightest person in the room, but I know if I identify, I might be one of you, and I'm just so not ready to be there. They talked about things that had happened in their life, and I would find my justification, but in my own small way, how I identified. And they talked about they losing their family, and many people have lost their family because of their drinking. Some have come back, some have not. But my smart aleck mind said, you know, if you need a family, you can have mine, because I no longer want them or need them. They're always talking about my drinking. And yet where I really lived, I knew it had been necessary for me to leave their home because it was no longer safe for them because of my drinking. I never saw it like that before. You talked about totaling out cars. And I did the majority of my driving under the influence. When I would be stopped for drunk driving, I worked for the city judge at the time that last year. And so I knew all the police, and they would take away my booze and tell me to go home. But I know that many people have had severe consequences from their DUIs. Maybe they were introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous as the result of that. But my attitude was I've never totaled out a car officially, you know. And I used to have a little car, you know, you buy them, they're rectangular. And then when you drink and drive the way I did, they get rounded out with the drunk bumps and things are falling off and mismatched and the window had been shot out of it. And in the end, my gas cap was a mitten I had stuck in there, you know. I'm like driving a Molotov cocktail around, basically, but it doesn't bother me a bit. That's drinking money, right? Mittens work. And so I heard you talk about losing jobs. Okay, well, maybe I have lost a series of little jobs because I can't keep showing up, and I've quit before I get fired, or I've been let go from a few. But that last year, I had a bad habit of quitting in blackouts. And that is kind of a problem because I don't know I've quit. So I go to work the next day, you know. And it's awkward, you know, basically. It's just kind of awkward. As I said, I'm not a good liar, so you just, oh, well, you know, type thing. But then you talked about all those broken promises. I thought, how do they know about those? Well, because you did them. And I hadn't been able to keep a promise since I was 12 years old and took that first drink. I didn't know that I didn't have the power of choice, that I had lost that power when I took that first drink. I didn't know that. Because I could go almost 2 weeks. It was always that second Friday that messed me up. I couldn't get past the second Friday on self-will, on I'm not going to drink. I couldn't get past that. The other thing there that you talked about was there was a woman who talked about scrubbing away the smell. And I thought, oh, she knows what the smell smells like. And she says she's an alcoholic. And she doesn't drink anymore. And I tell you, when I get to go on those 12-step calls, and yes, they still do happen, is I smell that used booze fragrance. And I'm always glad it's no longer the one I wear. And yet I know I am not so arrogant enough to think that because I have gotten to be here 40 years a day at a time that I can't find myself drunk somewhere down the road if I don't stay in the middle in the heartbeat of AA. People longer than me have picked up a drink. And I don't want to be, I want to be the example of what staying sober looks like, not leaving AA. So I have a responsibility here. And I thought to myself, you know, if I'm not careful, I might be one of those people. So I was going to be careful with my drinking. I was sent to an all-women's halfway house that took me to Minneapolis, and I would be there a total of 9 months. In the first 7 months, all I did was the bare minimum, which was don't drink, don't take anything else, and go to one AA meeting a month. Okay, like I said, I'm not going to join AA and go to two. I'm not going to get commitments or anything. I wasn't hearing any of that. And I came to California. I visited my mother for a 2.5-week holiday. The first week I'm out there hanging around the people I used to drink with. Last week and a half drunk and loaded with them. No surprise. I had no defense against the first drink. But the surprise was alcohol wasn't doing what it used to do. I had remembered it to be the fun and fantasy and the gay party time and all that. And this was with a couple drinks. I'm in a blackout for the rest of the week and a half. Drinking that time, thankfully, around people that knew me and in and out of lights. And I have really very to no recollection of that week and a half. And I was disappointed that that's what had happened. And I blamed it on California booze. That's really what I did. If I'd only been with my old friends. I mean, it's like I knew that that wasn't true, but I had to blame something. And I had the attitude that I've learned my lesson. But as I said earlier, it never got below my eyebrows. And 5 weeks go by, and I get a letter in the mail from these people in California, and it's got one joint in it. Somebody asked me about that the other day. How did that happen? I said, well, it was back in the day. I mean, you could do that at that time. I don't think you'd get by with that this day and age, but lots of things were different 40 years ago. And what you got away with, so to speak. And the minute I opened up that envelope and saw what was in there, I started plotting and planning. And I thought, well, you just never know when you might need something like that. You know, I'll just keep it. And it was amazing. I needed it the next day. You know, it just kind of worked out that way. And that Saturday afternoon, I had such great conflict. But it wasn't going to prevent me from smoking that one stupid joint. I didn't like pot. It was slow. It was stinky. You know, I want to get downtown right now, not in a couple hours. And so that's why I never liked pot, but it was there. And that's my great lesson to me, too, is that I don't have those kinds of things around in my home. And my husband's on that same page. Every family chooses for themselves, but for me, I don't want it to be so convenient. If I ever get to thinking that picking up a drink is a good idea, I want to have to find my keys and find my purse and get in the car and drive somewhere so God has an opportunity for sanity to come in. I don't want it to be this, I'm in this room and it's in that room, because I've had those thoughts that came out of nowhere and really scared the heck out of me. And so I don't want to make it convenient for me. And so that was my great lesson right there, because I kept something to alter me. So as I said, I smoked that one joint, and that was the last thing that I've taken to this date of my own hand to change the way that I feel or the way that I think. And that's how I got my sobriety date. The rest of the things they tell me is, they shared with me, is how I've kept it. Because it's so much more. I used to think it was just about don't drink and go to meetings. And I got to believe they probably said more, but until I was able to hear more, I wasn't going to do more. And I want to make sure that when I'm talking with someone new, you know, that I take a look at what is it I'm sharing with that new person. You know, one of the things that is on our minds, there's a feasibility study out there, and it's about how our membership has really been sort of stagnant for the last many years, and many of you are probably aware of that. But the question is, why is it? So I look at me, I look at my membership responsibilities. I look at what am I saying or not saying? What am I doing or not doing? You know, am I thinking that if I walk up to a new face, I don't know if they're new or maybe they're 100 years sober, but they've never been to this meeting before. Do I think that, hi, good to see you, is sufficient? Do I think that's enough? Would that have been enough for me? I find that I can have a completely different experience with just a little bit of engagement and a warm welcome, because I think you've all known each other since, you know, grade school, right? I don't know the secret code. At some point, though, y'all didn't know each other. But someone's act of kindness, Am I doing that? Am I making Alcoholics Anonymous attractive for a new member to come back? Have I done the exchange of phone numbers? Yeah, we may be pretty generous about giving out our phone number, but did I bother getting their number and calling them? I don't know about how many newcomers have actually called you in all the time you've given out a phone number, but probably not too many. There's a reason. They're terrified. I want to break that fear and make that hand reach out to them. Here's where I go to meetings. Would you like to go? Would you like to meet for coffee? Would you like a ride? Just wanted to see how you were doing today. I know new sobriety can be kind of scary. Here's where we're going. A gang's going here. A gang's going there. You're invited. You're welcome. Do I do that kind of personalization? What is my responsibility here as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? No, there's no dues or fees for membership, but we have expenses, and I have responsibilities. People were invited me and shared with me a way of life that was attractive. Now, I got to get up off the couch and go do it. But I felt more willing to do it than feeling like I was crashing a party if I felt like I got invited. And so they began to share with me some of these kinds of actions that they took. They shared with me about sponsorship. I have had the same sponsor, Millie G, for 29 plus years. I've had two sponsors prior to that. And it's a very active relationship because I'm an active participant in it. Again, when I seek her guidance and direction on something, I need to listen to it, as I mentioned earlier, without conditions, without negotiations. Liking it is not a requirement. Doing it is, for me. And I keep her apprised. That's the one person in my life that I must make sure that she knows the beauty marks and the warts, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I need to be transparent with someone, otherwise the ego takes over, and I'm only showing what I want you to see. And that will not be good for me. But sponsorship isn't good if I just keep it. The glow happens when I give it away. And what I do in sponsorship is I love sharing all three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous with them. The steps are recovery, and that's, if I only give them that, I kind of feel like I'm flatlining them. That's good, but my world went wow with the traditions and with the concepts. And so, and service, things like that. I want it all. I wanted it all drinking, and I wanted it all in recovery. And so I share with them those three legacies, but it doesn't work if they're going to just take from me. I won't sponsor takers. You got to be willing to pass this on too. However you can do that, you've got to also pass this on, because I know the glow that will happen within them. It's wonderful when you hear somebody get their first sponsee. They light up. I mean, and all of a sudden, Alcoholics Anonymous looks real different when you start your sponsorship. They talked to me about home group. I've had four different home groups because I've lived in four different parts of the country. And I realized that when I moved to Northern California, I've also had four different last names, as it turns out. You know, just kind of, just all legitimate, no alias, so... But a home group has taught me so many tools, has taught me about accountability, responsibility, being a part of, just one among many. It's taught me to show up early. So what kind of a home group member do I want to be, and what am I? You know, I show up early. My home group is Monday night, 8 o'clock, primary purpose. I get there at 7. The meeting is from 8 to 9:15. It's an open speaker meeting, 2 10-minute, a coffee break, and then the main speaker. Meeting's over around 9:15, and I'm the gatekeeper. So I'm the last one to leave, and I leave about 5 to 10. It's an evening event for me. I have several people who've said to me, gosh, you know, you drive from Concord down to Dublin, which is about a half an hour drive. So I leave my house about 6:20, and I get home around 10:30-ish or so. Isn't there something kind of closer for you to go to? And I see, yeah, there's plenty of meetings nearby me. There's even some groups. But I know, because it's inconvenient to me, it just seems to have a lot more commitment feeling on my part. There's plenty that are split seconds away from where I live. And they're nice for that fill-in, but my commitment has to feel that way, not just a convenience at my home group. I've always had a commitment there. That's not even an option. I mean, if they even said to me, no, all the commitments are full up. I mean, I can take one commitment and divide it into how many people I need to. Believe me, I know how to do that. If you want a job, I will give you a job. If they ever said that to me, I'd say, that's fine. I'll go greet in the parking lot before they hit the greeter door. I don't care. I need the commitment way more than the group needs me to have a commitment. I need the group way more than the group needs me. And I have to honor their customs. I don't know about your group, but everyone I've been in has always had a couple people that I just know they'd be happier somewhere else. I never tell them. I let them figure that out for themselves. But it's amazing. There was this one gal I remember. She came to the home group because her sponsor came. And as soon as her sponsor moved away, I thought, oh, good, she'll probably go too. No, she's still there, so I still get to practice spiritual principles, okay. But I always say hello to her. I never want anyone to know or to watch me to think, well, she doesn't like him or she doesn't like her. I want everyone to be treated fairly. I say hello to everybody, unless they get there 6 seconds before the meeting. If you're there so I can say hello, that is part of what I want to do. I want to welcome those new faces. I don't know if they're new or not, but it's important to make them feel welcome at that home group. So I believe so strongly in a home group and a real member in it, not just visiting that group. They talked to me about taking the steps. Taking the steps for me has a different feel when I describe that, because first of all, that's the language we use in chapter 5. And for me, taking them was an incorporation, one by one, of each of them. It wasn't a race, but there was a momentum that was started. And by taking each one of them, I know that when I really fully took the steps, I really did feel that. Now, again, what I'm sharing with you didn't happen day one, week one, month one. Okay, this is the Reader's Digest version. But when I took those steps, I really felt I was looking in that direction with step one. And by the time I got to the 12th step, I was in a new direction. I had a lot of new tools. Things had been cleaned up and amended and healed. And a relationship with a higher power, who I call God, was developed. And I am now at step 12. And it doesn't say to me, start over and get more information. It says, girl, you got your marching orders. Get out there and share with somebody who doesn't know there's a way out. And every time I get to walk someone through those steps, I'm doing it again as well. It keeps me fresh. Regardless of how long someone has been sober in my sponsorship, I will always take them through the steps one time. I personally don't do it more than once. I feel that, you know, I've given you the best I got. It's time for you to get to work so I can give it to someone else for the first time. So taking those steps changed my life. Because that bottom line of the triangle says recovery to me. It doesn't say sobriety. I need to bring physical sobriety for recovery to happen. But if all I'm doing is the not drinking, I will end up in trouble, as I have. I haven't done this right from the gate. I've had life's experiences, which I'll share with you in a second. They talked about the traditions. They said, okay, so you attend a group. You're a member of that group. You need to be an informed member of that group. And that's where the traditions come in for you to start learning. So that's part of your responsibility. But also, while you're at it, Deb, why don't you learn how to put those in your personal affairs? So when I began to put the traditions in a personal way, in home life and work life and sponsees or wherever it was, relationships, I began to have different results and better relationships in that way. It was no longer somebody's up and somebody's down, superior and inferior. It could come to the table as equals. And it gave me the opportunity to take the mirror that was constantly in front of my face down and see you when I put the traditions into play in that way. They really are so key and vital for me to honor and import into my life. And then they said service. Service, I find, is usually the stuff that's really inconvenient. Is the stuff that I get the biggest gift from. And it's, you know, whether it's answering the phone in the middle of the night, whether it's going to a meeting that's a long distance, it's the things I do out of that comfort level that I keep, it keeps it fresh for me. I think part of one of my favorite stories is some time ago, a couple years ago now, I guess, I was invited to talk at a 6:30 a.m. meeting. Now, for some of you, that's like noon, okay? It is not. That's the night before for me. I tell you, 6:30 a.m. is really early. And because I don't wake up and look like this, okay? You got to get up extra early. You got to be focused. You got to plan. You got to, you know, have your wits about you to put this all together. Okay? So, I mean, I said yes to the commitment, but I'm like, he has no idea what time I have to get up in order to be there, because I don't wear baseball caps and sweatshirts to meetings. I don't care what time it is. So I'm thinking, oh, how can I get out of this? How can I get out of this? Now, I know I'm not going to, but it became this like strange sort of ping pong match within my own head. And I'm thinking of how I'm going to get out of it, and I know that I'm not, but I still had fun thinking about it. And finally, the day comes, I'm having this conversation with myself, saying, okay, let me just make sure we get this straight. So you're saying that you've been invited to share your story to anybody who's willing to listen at 6:30 a.m., and you're balking about that. Yeah, yeah, okay. All right, let's just flip that over. When you were drinking, if they would have said to you, at 6:30 a.m. on Friday, this will be where the booze and the boys are? Would you have balked at that? Oh, God, no. I'd have been there at 6 o'clock. You know, I'd have been, where are they, you know? And what I saw with that analogy within me was, I know I have never been too tired to go out drinking. You could have called me at 11 o'clock at night. I'm on my way. I was never too far. Never too inconvenient. And I never gave it a second thought of where I was going to be, what I was going to do, who was there. And yet I will have some pauses. I say yes, but I'll have those pauses of moments, of seconds, hold off. I want to constantly make my reaction match, even though I say yes, I want my emotion and willingness to match that I did over here. And that is why I think that I get to live on the inside the way I get to live, because I really rely on that service and that God's going to provide me all the things that I need that it talks about in the third step. If I do his work well, he'll provide what I need. And so service is vital. It keeps it fresh. That's why sometimes there's comfort in keeping the same commitment forever and ever and ever. But on the other hand, for myself, I know that I like to have a rotation about my commitments. And the other was carry the message. I've gotten to journey through Alcoholics Anonymous through four cities. I've been married and divorced here, married again, currently married. Next month, April, it'll be 15 years. I'm married to a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has just been a joy to walk this path with him. He's 27 years sober. I'm 40. I just want you to know those numbers. I like it that he's a newcomer. And I never use it unless I need to, you know. He is, many of you know him, Kent, and he is a fine, fun member of Alcoholics Anonymous, heart as big as Texas. And I just love doing this journey with him. He inspires me, and we're such a wonderful fit together. He would have been here, but we realized he's actually on the other coast at an event. But when I got sober, I was sober in Minneapolis, and I was in the sunlight of the Spirit. I just felt it, and my first 4 years were there, and then I moved to Atlanta. Finally got to be a Southern Belle, and I moved to Atlanta just shy of my fourth birthday. Loved going back for the international and seeing all so many friends and go to my old home group, which was very emotional. I go back about every 2-3 years to Atlanta anyway, but that had just a special magic to it that last year. But I fell victim to that thought that we can get. And I was decided that, you know, 7 meetings a week is an awful lot of meetings when you're 4 years sober. I think I'm going to trim that down, get a little balance in my life. That I'd heard about this word balance. And I about balanced myself out of Alcoholics Anonymous is how that was working for me. I went from 7 meetings a week very quickly to 2 meetings a week. Now, it wasn't like I had education, children, working, elder care, anything, those other 5 nights of the week. No, it was 2 with you and 5 with me. Now, I don't care if you're a mathematician or not, that is not balance. That is very imbalanced. And after 2 years of that, and again, the front end of the meeting arrival shaved off over 2 years, the back end of the meeting shaved off over 2 years, and I'm 6 years, and so untreated in alcoholism. I've never left going to AA meetings. I have that sponsor. Hi, Joe, across the room. I don't sponsor anybody. And I show up and I look at my watch and can't wait to go. Because I know that I'm too afraid to drink. I know they told me in the beginning that if you, the first time you make the excuse, you'll have debate and guilt, but you won't the second time. And I've proved them right in other areas of my life when I've made that justification. But I was too afraid that I would end up drunk if I did that. So I went to AA, but all I did was take up space. And finally, that day came. I'm 6 years sober, and I am so restless, irritable, and discontented. And I'm thinking it's going to be a long life if this is what it's going to be like. And I came up with a plan that people, places, and things were going to make me happy. Now, the real definition is called men, money, and mansions are going to make me happy, okay? And I was on a mission. And I met this little fellow about 3 weeks later, and he had all the things I was looking for. Now, I knew I'd probably fall in love with him eventually, but, you know, that wasn't the requirement. And after the 3 months of this whirlwind romance, of which I was the only one involved, this little fellow, he got married to somebody else, and so I let him go. And seemed to look around the rooms, and bingo, there popped up another little fella and did this dance of delusion for 3 months, and he went down the aisle with somebody else. And at 6.9 years of sobriety, I came crashing down emotionally and spiritually into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, though I had never left you. I was so out there. I was on the dirt. And I recommitted myself. There's a line, again, a phrase in our book that says we could go on to the bitter end, that we had 2 alternatives, go on to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. And that to me was, you're either going to drink for relief or you're going to recommit yourself to Alcoholics Anonymous for relief. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, or returned with a vengeance, with an excitement. About a year later, I've taken those steps again. And this really did create the change in me, a spiritual awakening, a spiritual type of experience, a new way of life. I'm 8 years sober, and I'm hearing a guy talk about being a tad restless, irritable, and discontent. And he said, I was trying to live today on last year's program. Whoa, that's what I realized I'd been doing too, is that even though I took those steps, I'm still sort of doing some pats on the back. Good job, way to go. But what he showed me is that this is the day that counts. This is the day that we live in. Yesterday is done. Don't know about tomorrow. But what am I doing today? And my one day at a time looks like prayer and meditation in the morning, not an option. It is how I start my day. I love having that time with God. When we talk about self-support, I think about money, but I also think about all the other things that I have to do for self-support, and one of them is that prayer and meditation. And I wouldn't want anybody to do my prayer and meditation for me, so I also can't let anybody do my financial support of Alcoholics Anonymous for me either. And so I start off with that prayer and meditation, that time with God. I answer my phone as it rings throughout the day. I'm in service and I do what I say I'm going to do, and I show up where I say I'm going to show up, and I want my word to mean something. I want to reach out to those who maybe can't reach back. And then at night I'll close my day. I always want to try to close my day without owing anybody any amends. So I want to behave in a manner that makes that possible. And I close my day with some time with God again. And then in the morning, I get to start all over again with a fresh day. And that's what that one day at a time looks like for me. I later on would get married, move to Southern California, and about 5 years after that, 5 years and 9 months, that marriage would come to an end. And I had to take my own inventory because it's always so easy to point to them, but I really did have three pointing back at me. And I had to take my own inventory that I know zero about being in a good relationship. I don't know how to be a partner in it. I got a lot of other areas of life down pretty good, but this is not one of them. And I began to do some things differently. And it was like, you know, if God does have someone in store for me, I'd like to have something I can bring to the table. And 8 years later, I would meet my husband, Kent, and as the result of that, I would move to Northern California. I've known Lee a long, long time. A couple of last names I've known him for, of mine. His hasn't changed. So I'm up in Northern California, and we're on our first year anniversary, and we're back in Atlanta at a place where I, you know, was the last of the people, places, and things for Kent to meet. And we're at a luncheon one day, and it's with a mixed group of people, and at that luncheon was pre-poured wine. And I'm 26 years sober at the time. Not a big deal. I've been around alcohol before, but it'd never been pre-poured. And it just kind of, I don't know, threw me off a little bit. Pushed it out of my way, and this particular event, here I am in the middle of you at 26 years sober and have been for many years. I'm not a visitor to Alcoholics Anonymous since I turned 7. I've got what happened is what flipped on inside of me is a chemical craving for drunkenness, and that would be for 6 months. I didn't want to drink. It wasn't a mental obsession. It was absolutely like this chemical imbalance. And I've never heard of anybody talk about stuff like that. It started to scare the heck out of me because it wasn't going away. And after 6 months of this hovering around me like a buzzard, and just scaring the heck out of me, and I don't know what to do, and I've tried everything, and I don't even know how to describe it, is part of the problem too, is I don't even know how to talk about it, and I'm scared to talk about it. I'm afraid you're going to think you're not working a very good program and all that kind of stuff. And finally, I'm at a meeting one morning. I feel fine, but on my way home, I was gripped with the terror I would drink against my will. I'm now 27 years sober. And I called my sponsor, one of the many reasons to have a sponsor right there, and I dial her longhand. I always want to have her number laser beamed in my head. And I call her, and I'm so scared I'm crying. And I tell her what's going on, and she just simply said something I've known, but something that really began to change again the course of things. It was perfect for the moment. She said, "Honey, what we have is alcoholism, not alcoholism." And once again, a couple things came into my mind. One was about step 10. And talks about the daily reprieve, not the weekly reprieve, the monthly reprieve, the every AA birthday reprieve. It's about this day, the daily reprieve. But it doesn't come without effort, and that is because of the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I had always been, since seven, actively with a relationship with a God. And I know, and I felt the power between me and that first drink, or the feeling of the desire to go fulfill this imbalance. And the other was about in chapter 3, where it talks about that we're in the grip of a progressive illness. Only if over any considerable period of time, it gets worse, never better. And I looked at that differently too, and I'm like, okay, if I'm in the grip of a progressive illness, then I had better be in the action of a progressive recovery. My recovery has got to be out there. It cannot be coasting, because coasting is downhill. It never goes forward. I've got to be in the action of that. I don't want to wake up that tiger, because it doesn't take much, because backing off, all of a sudden, they start getting that scent when you get close. So being in the grip of a progressive action and recovery, this is what helps make my membership feel alive within me. And if you are feeling kind of stale, if you're wondering what you should do next, all I can do is say, let's jump in and let's do this together. Thank you very much.